that's not the normal intro music for my podcast. Hi, this is Chip LoCoco. Welcome to my podcast channel. That music is from the opera Mephistopheles by Arrigo Boito. The voice you heard was that of Norman Traigle from his complete recording of the opera for EMI. Norman Traigle was a bass baritone and perhaps the greatest voice to ever come from the city of New Orleans. Today, we're going to discuss his life and career with Mr. Brian Morgan. Brian is the former artistic director for Opera Crotonus in New York, the former program annotator for the New Orleans Opera, and Mr. Morgan's writings have appeared in various publications, including Opera News. He is also the author of the definitive book on the life and career of Norman Traigle. That book is entitled Strange Child of Chaos, Norman Traigle. Welcome, Mr. Morgan.
Good afternoon, Chip. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Brian, I know you were here to talk about the life and career of Norman Traigle, perhaps, like I said before, the greatest singer to come from New Orleans. Would you agree with that statement?
I would, and he has a lot of competition. I mean, when you think we could spend our entire time just talking about the great singers that have come from New Orleans, I think percentage-wise, it has got to be higher than any city in the United States, except possibly New York City, for obvious reasons. But the amount, including singers who are not well-known but were great singers, up to people like Mr. Traigle and Shirley Verrett, was born in New Orleans, even though she was raised in California. By the way, they were both born at Touro Infirmary. So if you want your child to become a great singer, I guess that is the place.
So in what year was Mr. Traigle born in New Orleans?
1927. He was born uptown on, he was born, as I said, at Touro Infirmary, and he grew up in a house on Carondelet Street.
And so as to be uptown New Orleans, what did his parents do for a living?
His father was a carpenter. His parents were from Ascension Parish, and they moved to the city before Mr. Traigle was born for Mr. Traigle's father to gain work here. He was a carpenter, and she was a homemaker.
Did he have any musical education that you would point to say, yes, he grew up surrounded by music, you know?
He did in the sense with a lot of musicians. He sang at his church. It was First Evangelical Church. The building still stands, but it's part of the Baptist church now, right near the Pontchartrain Hotel, right in back of Pontchartrain Hotel. And they had a big music program there. And so he really grew up singing in the church. I actually interviewed people for the book who remembered him singing as a boy soprano, if you can imagine.
Wow. So it seems like most of his, let's say, childhood was uptown. Where did he attend high school?
He went to Alce Forche High School. Again, the building still stands.
And since he didn't have a musical childhood, but you said that he did, he was in the chorus, he must have had a musical education, though, at some point in his life, correct?
Well, really, I would say it was after his mature voice, after his voice changed, and it was noticed he had a significant instrument. It was only then that he started attending Loyola University.
Really?
He had actually even made his debut with the New Orleans Opera in a secondary role in 1947. Then he started at Loyola University, where he studied with Elizabeth Wood, who was one of the, probably the top voice teacher in her day, although there too, she had a lot of competition. The top voice teacher at the time, and she really, he considered her a second mother. She really brought him up through the career, and she had had a minor career as a contralto, and obviously, she really worked very well for him.
Just out of curiosity, who were some of her other students who were, she's, you know, famous students?
I would say her other most successful and most famous student was John McCurdy, also a bass. We've noticed that before. Samuel Ramey and Paul Plitschka had the same teacher. Some teachers just specialize in voice types, it seems. And John McCurdy, and I think, I don't know this for a fact, that it was Mr. Traigle encouraged John McCurdy when McCurdy started his career here, even though he was not from here. And I suspect Mr. Traigle encouraged him as a good colleague to study with Miss Wood, and he claimed her for the rest of his life. He became a mainstay at the Metropolitan Opera and died just a few years ago as an old man.
Well, Brian, I'm going to stop right there just to say I am a Loyola graduate, so I have to mention Loyola University is well known for their music school. Can you just name, you know, a few of the singers who graduated from the voice program over at Loyola?
Well, I am a proud alumnus of Loyola as well. And in Mr. Traigle's day, we also had Audrey Hsu, Charles Anthony, who became still has the record for most performances at the Metropolitan Opera as a Compromario. Another Compromario, amazingly, two of the leading Compromarios in the Met history. Anthony LaTour, of course, was a different generation. Mr. Traigle's daughter, Phyllis Traigle, went to Loyola. Natalia Rome, Greer Grimsley. The list is considerable.
Mr. Brian Hemel.
Of today's singers,
Brian Hemel. It's quite an accomplishment for a little Jesuit university here over in New Orleans, isn't it?
Indeed. But they, you know, in my day at Loyola, and I think it was the same before and since, the theory program was so challenging, and we had great voice teachers and many great teachers as well.
So here's Norman Traigle studying music at Loyola after he already had made his debut, let's call it, at the New Orleans Opera. At a university with a wonderful music program for opera, right? Down in the city of New Orleans, which is the city that is known for jazz. Most people, when you think of New Orleans, is going to think of jazz. However, New Orleans has had a significant impact on the history of opera. Would you care to discuss that a little bit and go a little bit further into the cultural arts of New Orleans itself?
Before the Civil War, New Orleans was the opera capital of the country, like New York is today. So we have, there's the famous old French Opera House, which there's so many legends about. But and in the 20th century, in the 1940s, when Mr. Traigle was a young man, the 30s and 40s, New Orleans Opera Association started up. And in Mr. Traigle's day, they had like 8 or 10 operas in a season. The top stars in the world sang here, some of the great conductors. It was really, and then the other, we've had a great orchestra all throughout. And many other, yes, people associate New Orleans with popular music now, but we have a strong tradition of the fine arts. And when Mr. Traigle was alive and in his youth, we had so many ensembles and things going on, and churches did full oratorios, and we have a little of that, but there was a lot more back then.
So, I mean, I know Walter Hebert, of the a conductor here, general director of the New Orleans Opera, as well as Renato Cellini, started bringing in some big name people from out of New Orleans.
Oh yes, well, Walter Hebert was this pupil of Schoenberg. He used to play in ensembles with him. So he brought all of these great Mrs. Traigle, Mr. Traigle's late wife, told me that was when opera in New Orleans was just at its peak in her lifetime. It was in the Hebert days. They did, full-length Wagner operas and all of this, and with the Kirsten Flagstad, and it was really a wonderful place to grow up and to be exposed to such great musicians.
And I know the New Orleans Opera, over the years, has released some of those recordings, live recordings from New Orleans. I'll mention one in particular, it's always stood out to me, was a 1959 performance of La Boheme with Giuseppe Di Stefano.
I think your favorite tenor, am I correct?
Alicia Albanese, Giuseppe Valdengo, and the colline of
Norman Traigle. Is particularly interesting. Everyone who was alive back then remembered that production because it was so great. And it was the role that Mr. Traigle made his New York City Opera debut 6 years before that. So we don't have a recording of that, but this is really a momentum of that, and that's really where it kick-started his career.
And I know we're going to get into his career at New York City Opera, but first I want to talk about his instrument. The great Swedish tenor U.C. Björlin, when he wrote his autobiography, entitled it, "My Throat is My Luggage," which I always thought was kind of interesting. And you have Norman Traigle with this humongous bass baritone voice. And it really does embody, I would come to imagine, who he was. It became part of, that was him, was his voice and what he could do with it. So I wanted to ask you to describe his instrument to the listeners for those who maybe not have heard him yet.
Well, of course, describing a voice is very difficult. But the one thing that, I interviewed many, many people from all generations, as I said, even people who remembered him as a boy soprano, and was the size of the voice, the cutting power of the voice. It was so powerful. Samuel Raimi, who followed Mr. Traigle in many of his roles at the City Opera and really had a much bigger career than Mr. Traigle ever did, partially because he lived so much longer, thank goodness he's still with us, said that the phrase that you played at the opening of your program, the prologue in heaven, when Mephisto sings, "Hail, Lord," in a sarcastic way to God, of course. He said everyone felt pinned back in their seat just on the opening phrase, and it went on from there.
Oh, wow.
I heard a different story that Paul Plischka was in the audience for one of these Mephistopheles, another great bass of the next generation, and he turned to Raimi afterwards and said, after the performance was over, I'm going to need a lot of beers to get over this performance. Forget about this one. Beverly still said the last 15 minutes, who's a good friend of his, the last 15 minutes of Mephistopheles, she had never seen anything like that in her life and hadn't seen it since.
Well, I'll say this, and you mentioned that it's hard to describe a voice. So, of course, you know, let's talk about Enrico Caruso, correct? We have recordings made on at the very beginning of records, correct? Tinty. Hard to exactly, probably getting a low percentage of what his voice actually sounded like. So you have to turn to people who actually heard him live to get, what did that voice sound like? Different for Norman Traigle, because we and the listeners today can go to YouTube or to Spotify, go type in Norman Traigle's name and listen to that voice and kind of get a sense for what it was like.
Right, the presence of the voice. But we all know, for instance, his friend Beverly Sills, I heard twice in the theater. As wonderful as her recordings are, there's nothing like being in the theater with a voice.
Correct.
But I agree with you that the recordings really did capture as much as humanly possible of the instrument. It was very dark sound, yet had a cutting edge. But the most important thing about Traigle's voice is how expressive it was. And that's what he wanted to be thought of as. He took that great instrument and twisted it around in the name of expression, wrung it out dry. Sometimes the next days after a performance, he could barely get out of bed because his commitment was so total. The level of intensity. And to sing these difficult roles like the Boito Mephistopheles, I mean, it's just incredible. He says the instrument was like a trombone playing a trumpet part.
Wow.
The Mephistopheles was so difficult.
So unlike UC Berlin, who says that my throat is my luggage, it really was his entire being.
I think he would say that. And then you look at the relative little film that we have of him, we can see the total mastery over his body. He approached movement in opera like choreography, which I think also is the way to go, because you are not so much expressing the text as much as the music, and he was able to do that.
You mentioned the film remnants of him. One in particular I'd like to point out is his role as Olin Blitch, Reverend Olin Blitch, in Susanna. Can you explain that opera a little bit?
That was his first great success. It was Carlisle Floyd's opera, Susanna, based on Susanna and the Elders from the Old Testament. And he said it with a southern dialect from the Carolinas. And Floyd had, it was his first success too. He had, when they brought it to New York City. And it was 3 years after Mr. Traigle's debut in New York. So it's 1956, and he really scored a huge success. And this is, it's a flamboyant reverend from an evangelical background, as they used to say, a Bible thumper. And 2 years after that premiere in New York City, he was filmed in New Orleans in the revival scene, which is really the heart of the role of Reverend Blitch. And he was a part of a long concert at the Municipal Auditorium, but TV cameras from Channel WDSU came just to film the Susanna, and they made a kinescope of it, which Mrs. Traigle kept in her closet her whole life until I heard about it, and then brought it to Phil Johnson, the late Phil Johnson at Channel 4, had him transfer, I knew the TV station could do it, transfer the kinescope into a modern film. And then a few years later, the Bel Canto Society published it on VHS, and now it's on YouTube, and it is electrifying.
In preparation for our little meeting today, I reviewed that last night, and it is electrifying. He takes over the whole stage. He's a master. He's a vocal actor is what he is. He's an opera singer, but he's a vocal actor. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Oh, yes. And that's how he wanted to be thought of. And that part really just, you know, he was 2 degrees background, being a southerner and so forth. So he really got under the skin of that part. And you can see in that film of Susanna, one of the most characteristic things of his appearances, he was extremely thin, especially considering the cliche of an opera singer. He was 5'11 and never weighed more than 138 pounds.
A beanpole.
Yes, that was one of his several nicknames.
A beanpole with an extremely huge, deep, resonant voice.
That was such the contradiction. Even his voice teacher, Miss Wood, couldn't understand that. She explained it by that he had his resonance long ways rather than width. So his rib cage, she thought, might have been a little longer than. But when you even see his clothes that are still left over, and I remember many years ago, before their terrible fire, the City Opera had an exhibit of costumes and had his Mephistopheles costume. It looks like he would fit a child. He was really so small. And to have such a big voice is just absolutely incredible.
Incredible. So let's get into Mr. Traigle's career a little bit. I know you mentioned that he started singing at the New Orleans Opera, went to Loyola, then he started singing again at New Orleans Opera again. But that's not where he really found his home, correct?
When he appeared with the New Orleans Opera, he did many secondary roles. And I think the first that one would call a major role was in 1950. He did the Count de Grieux in Manon, opposite Bidou Sayaw, who was a famous Manon of the day. But in 1950, he noticed with all the singers that came to New Orleans to sing, those singers from the Metropolitan Opera tended, although there were exceptions, of the type that stood there and sang beautifully, but were not, actors. They did not act.
They didn't act.
The small roles were done by local people like himself, and the middle roles tended to be, the secondary roles tended to be people from the New York City Opera. And he noticed they acted as well as sang. And he knew, according to his personality and his way of thinking, that's what he wanted to do. So he didn't even audition for the Metropolitan. He auditioned for the New York City Opera.
Because he was an actor. He thought the New York City Opera was where his best fit, what his approach to opera was.
And his instinct was correct. Because it was at the City Opera. He started there in 1953 with La Boheme. In 1956 was the first Susanna, which was his first really great success. All the international press was there, so he had a huge success with that.
That was the debut of the opera, correct?
It was the New York debut. It had been done more or less as a student production in Florida, where Mr. Floyd taught. Phyllis Curtin was a soprano in Florida, though, but the baritone who sang it in Florida, Mac Harrell, could not do it in New York. That's when Mr. Traigle stepped into it. It's kind of a fluke.
And he owned the role.
Yes, for as long as he wanted to sing it.
At the New York City Opera, Brian, what other roles would you say did he thrive in, and which, you know, today you may be able to go pick up a recording of and listen to?
Well, he never, compared to the level of his success and fame, he never made that many recordings. But the progression of the City Opera, the next great role, I would say, after Susanna, was his Mephistopheles in Gounod's Faust, which, again, he found one of his great roles. Some people think it was his greatest role. He sang that opera more often than any other opera in his life. And then the New York City Opera moved to Lincoln Center, which had recently opened in, I think, 1966. They opened with a big production of Handel's Julius Caesar, which was extraordinarily rare in those days. Tito Capobianco was the director, who ended up being Mr. Traigle's favorite director. And a soprano by the name of Beverly Sills sang Cleopatra. And he was really miscast in that, and he knew that himself. It did show that he could really sing in terms of all of the roulades and coloratura and agility that he was able to show that he had. But His friend Beverly Sills certainly stole that show. Luckily, it was recorded by RCA, which was his first complete opera.
And you can still pick that up today.
Yes, it's on CD.
His friendship with Beverly Sills was really, really good.
Yes, it became an extraordinary partnership, as she herself admitted. And really, after his death, she did a lot to continue his name. Now we have, you know, my biography of him. We have all these issued recordings of him, reissued and first issued, the film of him. This, for many years, I think what tends to happen when a celebrity dies, there goes a quiet period. Well, in that quiet period, she kept his name alive in her books and interviews and so forth.
Gotcha.
She thought he was incomparable.
How old was he when he died?
47.
He was only 47 years old.
Yes.
What would you say is his legacy today?
Well, I think the legacy is the importance of a singing actor. He also was a great proponent of contemporary opera, which a lot of famous singers were not then. But he did operas by Floyd, William Walton. The most advanced opera he sang was in 1966, Dalla Piccola's Il Prigioniero. Dalla Piccola was the first great Italian serialist, and it was Leopold Stokowski who conducted that. That was issued, a recording of it did survive. We don't understand how that recording happened because you can hear there's no audience in it, yet it was not broadcast over the radio. So we really don't know how that came about. It was probably something doing of Stokowski, who, of course, was a huge celebrity by 1960. Anyway, it was recorded on it was distributed on Opera Depot, and it's a magnificent performance.
And has New Orleans Opera done anything to recognize his legacy?
Well, many years ago, around 1978, a portrait of him as Julius Caesar was commissioned. Why Julius Caesar? Because they didn't want him looking like a demon in the painting. And it's a beautiful painting. I'm not sure that it's still up with all the vagaries of, I think it, after Hurricane Katrina, it was taken down and put in storage. But 10 years ago, that does not seem that long, Trego Plaza was dedicated in front of the Theater for the Performing Arts, which is next to the Municipal Auditorium where Mr. Trego made his debut, and he inaugurated in, I think, 1973, the Theater for the Performing Arts with a performance of Verdi's Requiem conducted by his friend Werner Turkanowski, who many people remember as a really great part of New Orleans' legacy, I think.
So, Brian, I want to turn to your book. The title, again, is Strange Child of Chaos. I would love for you to explain to listeners, what do you mean by that title? Why did you choose that title?
Well, your audience may have seen Mr. Trego costumed as Mephistopheles, and that will give you an idea of what he looked like in the role. In Act One of the opera, Faust, he appears before the old man Faust. And the first thing out of his mouth is, strange child of chaos. And Mr. Trego loved cultivating that image of the operatic villain and so forth. So I think that Dixie Devil, he was even called at one time. So I think that he would have appreciated that. And I do think posterity will have that was his greatest role.
And he didn't have an easy life, did he?
No, he didn't. He had, I would say, a lot of inner demons. He was always constantly frustrated. It's hard to imagine that today to have a great singer addicted to cigarettes, but he most certainly was. He smoked, I think, 8 packs a day or something like that. He was, according to his daughter, Phyllis, he smoked nonstop all day long except at meals.
Wow.
There are stories that in the wings of, in the theaters when he was singing, especially Mephistopheles and Faust, he would have stagehands on either side of the stage holding cigarettes that he would go and take a puff of during the opera. And then would come back on stage and emit smoke, which was, of course, perfect for that. It wouldn't work in Manon, but it worked in Faust.
I know he loved the fairgrounds. He loved gambling on the horses, right?
His home away from home. And according to Miss Sills, he did occasionally get into some trouble with his gambling, but it was his absolute passion. His father had taken him there as a child, and even after he died, the racetrack had a memorial race in his honor.
And he was a drinker as well, correct?
He drank a lot of scotch, again, these are things that it's almost unheard of for singers to cultivate these sorts of habits. You know, I think Enrico Caruso, whom you mentioned earlier, smoked, but in those days we had a different conception of it. I mean, by Mr. Traigle's day, we knew how dangerous it was. Right. And to smoke to that extent and drink to that extent is really incredible. And he had trouble in his home life. You know, he had two marriages, and by the time he died, the second marriage had failed. So he was definitely a frustrated and unhappy person for whatever reason.
Your book is phenomenal. I'll say that.
Thank you.
What I loved about the book was the research that went into it, in your the interviews that you conducted with the different singers who and conductors, who stage directors who performed with him or worked with him, and just hearing them describe his voice and his presence was outstanding.
Chip, I could write a book about writing the book, because it was so fascinating meeting all of these people, many of whom had been heroes of my youth. I mean, meeting Beverly Sills at her offices at Lincoln Center, and she was so gracious. She knew how to both conduct an interview and give an interview, because I think every word she spoke I used in the book or in subsequent articles. Tito Capobianco, Frank Corsaro, I mean, all of these people, Julius Rudel, with the famous conductor that he did have a contentious relationship with. But Rudel was very gracious and invited me to his home in New York City. So many other singers and directors, as you say, it was just a fascinating journey. Some via letter, some by a phone, interviews in person.
So I'm going to pretend like I'm Brian Morgan. I make the phone call and I say, "Hi, my name is Brian Morgan, and I'm talking to a conductor, let's say. I'd like to talk to you about Norman Traigle." What would be their first, what was their first reaction almost across the board?
Well, you could tell with most of them, their minds are transported back to their younger days and remembering him. And he was such a vivid memory to almost all of these people. There were some people, and I found this very, very curious, and I don't think I've ever expressed this to anyone, even privately. There were still people angry at him. They were angry that he had basically, to put it simply, not taken better care of himself and been more of a diplomat in his personal life so that he could have sung in more of the great theaters. There were many theaters he slammed the door on the way out.
You mentioned about great theaters. In doing my research for today, I came across an article right when he died. It was right after he died. And the article basically said that the people who knew him best were not really surprised by his death, I guess because of the way that he was living his life, yet were very saddened by his death, particularly because he seemed to be on the cusp of his career really taking off. And the article was written in such a way that it was, of course, talking about the Metropolitan Opera. Why didn't he ever really sing at the Metropolitan Opera?
That is a complicated and long subject, but to put it simply, Rudolph Bing had a bit of a prejudice, who ran the Metropolitan for most of Mr. Traigle's career, had really, as Miss Sills has very often stated, had somewhat of a prejudice against American singers. He would allow them in, shall we say, through the back door for secondary roles or, you know, replacement in the cast after the star, the Italian star has left, and he never even, the only thing that Mr. Traigle had a contact with the Metropolitan during Sir Rudolph's regime was to understudy a performance of Faust. And he sat in Bing's box for that. With incidentally, the Mephistopheles was Justino Diaz, who's still very much with us. Recently had a great award in New York, in Washington, D.C. After Rudolph Bing retired, immediately the Metropolitan started contacting him. Goran Gentile was to have, the Swedish stage director, was to have ran the Met, but he made immediately overtures to Mr. Traigle. They had hoped for an English language production of Boris Godunov, which was one of Traigle's great roles. Then Gentile died in a car accident. Then it became a triumvirate of John Dexter, whom I knew very well and was an admirer of Mr. Traigle, and Schuyler Chapin. And he made overtures to Mr. Traigle, too. I don't think, in hindsight, Mr. Chaplin was quite patient enough. He really operated through Mr. Traigle's entourage, his people, as they say, and offered him several things. Il Prigioniero, Johnny Schicchi, John Dexter's production of I Vespri Siciliani. For various reasons, he turned all of that down. Then they decided on a new production, which meant that it would be a very high level and high publicity, of Massenet's Don Quixote, his opera in Don Quixote, which Mr. Traigle had planned on singing but then withdrew. So he never sang the complete opera. He would sing the final scene, which is very beautiful, in concert, and he recorded it. But as this was about to go to press, the announcement of it, he withdrew. No one knows exactly for certain why, but Michael Devlin, another bass baritone whom Mr. Traigle considered his protege, told me that he felt Don Quixote simply wasn't a great opera, that it was a great last act. But I think it is true that Mr. Traigle's career was taking a turn on the international level. He had just sung at Covent Garden in a new production of Faust. But also I think in his private life he was trying to turn it around. He admitted he was addicted to sleeping pills and was trying to get over that addiction. He apparently did not think smoking or drinking was a problem, but he did realize that sleeping pills were a big problem. I think when he was in London, he ran out of his prescriptions, and it became a problem.
So, Brian, I know you're the biographer of Norman Traigle, but more than that, you're a fan.
Oh, most certainly. I think he was one of the greatest opera singers that ever lived. For me, he's one of my three absolute favorite singers, the other two being Maria Callas, who was an admirer of his, attended a performance of Mephistopheles, and John Vickers, the great tenor, who was a friend of Mr. Traigle, that sang together more than once, and I was able to interview Mr. That would be an example of what you asked about earlier. I wrote Mr. Vickers a letter, and he called me in return. I was so shocked and was able to tape the conversation with his permission, and he called Mr. Traigle his soulmate.
His soulmate.
Yes.
That's beautiful. So you mentioned the top singers that you love. I'd like to know, what are the top recordings of Norman Traigle that you would say, these are the must-dos? If somebody's going to say, what should I listen to, these are what my recommendation would be.
Number one would be his 1973 recording of Mephistopheles. It's his greatest role. His colleagues are great, Placido Domingo, who was a friend of his, and Montserrat Caballé. It's recorded in state-of-the-art sound, and the CD issues are terrific. And secondly, I would say a recording that was made 50 years ago this year of The Tales of Hoffmann, which he sang the four villains in. That was another early success of his. And he was able to record it in a magnificent recording that I think is very underrated. Beverly Sills sings the four heroines. Suzanne Morrissey, who's a friend of mine and was an admirer of Mr. Traigle and friend, sings the role of Niklos, and it's a magnificent recording.
So I'm a listener today, and I start listening to YouTube and go pick up these recordings, and I fall in love with Norman Traigle myself. Of course, you run a Facebook page entitled what?
That's right. It's the Norman Traigle Appreciation Society, and we have hundreds of people in it. Even today, it came across on YouTube that a live recording, 1964 Carnegie Hall performance of La Juive, still today a rarely done opera, but a magnificent opera, that he sang at Carnegie Hall with Richard Tucker, who was a great exponent of that part, and sang it years later in New Orleans, in fact, in a stage version. So that was produced. And so we have alerts like that and alerts to, you know, his colleagues and his recordings and everything. So I would certainly encourage people on Facebook to sign up for it.
And repeat the name again?
The Norman Traigle Appreciation Society.
Well, Brian, I found this extremely entertaining today. I hope our listeners, really come away with a feeling of they got to know Norman Traigle a little bit better. I'll mention this, which I find amazing, and that is Norman Traigle died at the age of 47. Mm-hmm. Mario Lanza died at the age of 38. Enrico Caruso died at the age of 48. These gentlemen came on like gangbusters and departed us before they were 50 years old.
Yes.
But their legacy lives on through music, through writings like your book, and through film.
Indeed. And there's a let's face it, there's a romantic element of dying young. And I think with the three singers you mentioned, that indeed is the case. We did not hear them singing past their best. They didn't enter a bitter, demented old age. So,
correct. They left us at a point where their voice lives on.
Quite right.
Thanks, Brian. And again, feel free to look out for his Facebook page. And if you can, pick up his book, Strange Child of Chaos. It's available on Amazon. And Brian, thanks again for coming.
Thank you, Chip.